Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Time again for the Science Forum. The gang is back. They've been cracking wise, and they're loosened up and ready to go for the show. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for our scientists today. 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org, or call us 800-348-2551. Three scientists here. They're all being very funny. It'll be a hilarious show. Not much science, but you'll laugh a lot. Stick around. We'll be back. Oh, hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. I'm thrilled today because it's Science Forum Day, and it's always a fun show. Most of the time. We have our scientists with us today who are going to answer your questions about anything at all, whether it's hot coffee or electric water heaters, whatever you want. 800-348-2551. They know everything. 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Vox, that's VOXPOP, one word, @wamc.org. That's our email. The number is 800-348-2551. You don't even need to have these people introduced by now, but let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
First off, Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist, and I teach biology and chemistry, shocker, at SUNY Cobleskill.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired now.
Ed Stander, and I am not a chemist. Quantitatively, I am not a chemist.
Okay.
I do astronomy, geology, environmental science, and anything that Jim or Barbara can answer.
And I guess you owe me some thanks.
Thank you,
Kobe people.
Yes.
I got you out of a meeting, yeah?
Yes. Our colleagues are probably not listening to us because there is a faculty meeting at SUNY Cobleskill as we prepare for the start of the semester.
When does the semester begin?
The 26th, so 2 Mondays from now.
So you're excited?
Oh,
always
terribly.
Excited.
Always excited.
Everything
yes.
Looking good? You got a lot of full classes and everybody is ready to go?
Actually, very full classes,
yeah.
Yes. I certainly do. I think Ed's got... No, you're full,
I'm
too.
I'm full, too. Yeah,
yeah.
In fact, the room can only hold 49 because there's only 2 doors. So that's
Fire
as
Marshall.
Full as it gets.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, before the show, Stacy Rosenberry, bigwig here, came in with a rock. Ed, what was that all about?
You didn't tell me she was a bigwig. I would have given her some more information.
She's a very bigwig.
Yeah, I could have told her it was a piece of gold or platinum or something.
But then you would
better.
Be lying, right?
Scientists don't lie.
Scientists don't lie.
Isn't there
don't...
a canon of ethics for scientists of some kind?
No, it was a piece of Onondaga limestone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, interesting.
And Onondaga limestone happened to have occurred, the limestone or the mud, lime mud that was there, happened to have occurred during a period of time when there were a lot of volcanic activity.
Mm.
And the volcanoes spewed off an awful lot of silica, and the silica got into the rock and became the source for shells of little creatures called radiolarians.
Wow.
And then when they died, they fell down and they formed flint. So the Onondaga contains a lot of flint.
Now, how long ago was this region volcanically active?
It was volcanically active from about 450 to 350 million years ago.
So that's an old rock.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, it's unfortunately radio and you can't see it. And besides, she took it with her. But we'll just go right to the emails. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. This one's from Ross. Riddle me this, says Ross. Why does a cup of coffee reheated in a microwave cool down faster than a hot cup of coffee poured directly from a pot? Admittedly, I've never actually measured the temperatures of each cup described, but over 40 years of experience, it occurs without fail that a microwave cup of coffee cools down faster. What's the science behind this? And that's from Ross.
Well, how hot is too hot is really what it comes down to. When you think about a brewed pot of coffee,
Yeah. You're
taking water and you're heating it up quite hot, almost to boiling, and you're throwing it on top of the grounds, and then it's percolating through the grounds and into the pot below. That pot below has a burner underneath it to keep it
maybe.
Pretty warm.
Yeah.
Right, maybe. Sometimes now they have, you know, these thermos vessels instead of the actual, like, reheated pot. So it'd be good to know if he has, like, a Mr. Coffee with the good old burner underneath, but that's my guess. So you're going to be at a hotter temperature in that pot than you would be coming out of the microwave after, like, the hitting the beverage button, because what that gets to you is about 125, 130 Fahrenheit, which is still hot enough to go, ow, but... it's not as hot as you might get on the burner in your Mr. Coffee.
So at a certain stage, your mouth and your tongue really can't tell the difference?
Well, there's ow and then there's ow, I guess.
Right.
But,
I,
you know, we all have our own tolerances, too.
I beg to differ
ever
so slightly.
Here we
yes, go.
Go
for it.
Controversy.
Well, if you take, forget the coffee for a second.
Okay.
Just take two cups, one with boiling water in it and one with water from a microwave.
Mm-hmm.
Which is going to be hotter?
Well, the cup with the boiling water will be hotter because there'll be heat transfer from the liquid to the cup, and it will heat the cup up more than the cup will heat up in the microwave because it's a different method of heating.
Okay, let me ask you this then. If you take that cup that you put in the microwave, okay, and you got it nice and hot, and then you put something in that cup, just a little bit of sugar, for example, it starts to bubble all over the place. It boils right off the top. Why does it boil if it's too cold to boil?
I don't know what you mean by the sugar boiling in a... Oh, you mean if you were to heat a microwave
Take the microwave cup, it becomes very dangerous.
And we wouldn't do this at home.
No,
we would not take an empty cup and put it in the microwave.
No, not empty. If you take a cup full of water,
for
example, and you put it in the microwave, and then you put some hot chocolate stuff in it, for example, it bubbles all over the place.
Oh, I see. So because of the superset,
because it's superheated.
Supersaturation, superheated.
Now, if it's superheated, it's got to be hotter than the cup that came from the came off the stove.
Yeah, I think what it all comes down to how it is that you do the heat, how your settings are.
On the microwave.
Because if you do it the safe way, which would avoid the superheating.
Yes.
Right, the beverage button.
Then it would get not as nearly as hot as coming out of the pot.
A lot of these new microwaves, in fact, I had one that was like an early 90s microwave that finally bit the dust during COVID. And I bought a new one, and the new one has a sensor in it,
right.
And you don't even have to put anything in your coffee. It just senses as it's there. Yeah. And won't let you get it hotter.
Does it drink it for you, too?
It makes a cute little tune. Annoyingly every minute if you forget your coffee.
Coming off. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But if you have a superheated cup of water coming out of a microwave, it's going to be hotter than the one that comes off the stove.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's what he's drinking. He's drinking coffee.
Now, Ross didn't specify whether he uses the same cup. What if the cup was made of different materials, the one that he puts in the microwave?
Matter.
He wouldn't do that.
It also matters if the coffee he's reheating is like with milk and sugar in it or if it's the black stuff that's coming out of the pot.
You see what you've done, Ross? Now, this was about an 8-minute conversation about heated coffee. So we're really, this is vintage science form right here.
But we should, if he has the misconception that there's something different in the physics of how it cools.
Hot is,
it's not.
If it's the same stuff,
if it's the same stuff at the same temperature, starting at the same temperature, it's going to cool at the same rate.
Right. And some people preheat their cups before they pour coffee into it, like they put some hot water in
really?
It. Yeah, because I had a...
They don't want to crack them.
I had an aunt who was really particular about her tea, and she wanted to scald the inside of her mouth with tea. So she would pour, you know, from the tea kettle, hot water into her cup, preheat the cup.
But that's different than coffee
again. I know it's different. It's different, right?
Tea has to be at... Supposedly, most teas are supposed to be at 200 and some odd degrees, and therefore it should be just at boiling. And so you put it in a cup that's cold, the temperature of the water drops almost immediately, and the tea doesn't come out as well.
So she would send cups back, like when we were out at a diner, because it was never hot enough, never hot enough. So she would preheat it with the boiling water, throw that out, and then fill it with tea, and then throw the tea bag into it and drink it within a minute.
Wow, this is interesting. I'll tell
there you go.
We're going to send this one right to the Museum of Broadcasting. The number here is 800-348-2551. This is, we're off to a flying start here on the Science Forum. Let's see, it's Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz here with us today. Mary writes in, what is schist rock composed of, and why do different pieces look so different from each other, even from the same quarry? And that's from Mary in Delmar.
God, that's
how you say this.
It's a geology question. It's so
schist.
Cool. Yeah, a schist rock is usually a rock that started off as mud and then went and became shale. And then after a while, mudstone and then shale, and then slate, because you keep on applying pressure to it. And sooner or later, the minerals start to grow in it.
Ah.
It gets so hot that
how
you get
they
minerals
grow?
Growing. Effectively from the pressure and temperature. So they're growing inside the rock.
They become insoluble with each other, so they precipitate out as
that
different
amazing.
Material.
Yeah. And so they're called, that's effectively what makes a rock called schist. So you go from mudstone to shale to slate, finally to schist. And depending on what was inside the shale at the beginning, you get, yes, I'm being careful.
No, I know, you're doing great, but the delay button is right here. Just continue.
Yeah, no, if you, depending on what is inside the shale at the beginning or the mud that it came from, you'll get different minerals forming. And, of course, the temperature determines it as well.
So you can have different types of schist depending on what the shale was?
I'm trying, yes. You can have a hornblende schist, which contains hornblende, or you can have a mica schist that contains mica. It depends on the temperature and the pressure.
All right.
So what about her being in the same quarry and getting samples from the same quarry?
Well, rocks vary in various places, layered by layers. And since you start with a sedimentary rock, some may contain more lime, some may contain more shale. It all depends on what it starts off as.
Well, enough of this schist. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Schist. It's a rock. We just talked about it. Okay, we'll be back. Little Ray Charles for you there. That'll cool you down after that exciting intro to our program. It's the Science Forum today. We have Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabitz with us here to answer your science questions. Before we get to Tom in Scotia and the first call, Barbara, you brought up something during the break that I was going to talk because the coffee.
Two coffee gurus here, you and me, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it was such an exciting conversation, I didn't want to wreck the flow. But really, when you heat up a cup of coffee, it never tastes as good. Why?
It doesn't because the oils are different. So the watery part of the coffee, I don't know really how else to describe it, are the water-soluble components of the coffee bean. But a lot of the aroma and flavor and the differences of one coffee bean to another coffee bean are the oils that are in the coffee beans themselves, because they do contain an oil, and then how the roasting process changes those oils, either breaks them down or combines them somehow, so that the oils are going to respond differently by the microwaving heating than if you've got the fresh pot there that you've got the oils. And the smell as well, because the smell often comes off of those aromatic oils.
All right. Now, you seem to be an expert on this. And so let me ask you this
just
follow-up.
Just curiosity got me here.
Follow-up
yeah.
question.
Okay.
I get up 4:45 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Coffee's on. I put the coffee on. Others in my house get up later. And so I'll keep reheating it. Now, if it doesn't get cool, is it still going to be fine for a couple of hours?
A couple of hours. There are those volatiles. Really, the smell part is going to dissipate pretty quickly. That's why fresh ground coffee smells so good, why fresh brewed coffee smells so good. And also, if it's heated too high, you can denature or break down those oils and get kind of that acrid,
yeah,
biting smell.
But even so, in other words, even if you leave it on warm and it stays hot,
yep,
and never cools down.
Right. You lose some of those oils. Those volatiles will come off, just like perfume. It's coffee perfume, which I would vote for.
Yeah. Would you use that?
I would totally use
okay.
it.
So yeah. If you were to take the bottle and seal the top off so the volatiles stay inside, would that help the coffee?
We couldn't keep
heating
it up.
Think about it, Jim. As long as the heating process didn't combine or denature the oils, I think we would be pretty close. There are actually sniffers, like like bomb sniffing devices that you can use that will take the aromatics off of any system, whether that be something forensic or whether coffee. And I read an article years and years ago when I was in graduate school about sniffing the stuff that's in the aroma above coffee and then running it through an analysis and identifying the molecules that are coming off of the coffee.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
You know, it's very similar with cigars. If you have a cigar and it's just too much, you don't have time, and you stop smoking it and then you go back to it later, it ain't the same.
It ain't the same. And humidor, of course, it's dehumidifying, right, as you're smoking it. And that's why the humidity is such a concern for cigars.
Yeah, right. That's why, for example, bottles of wine, they'll get you can buy things that pump in anything but air into the bottle.
Oh, I see.
To keep the flavors
right.
in.
The oxygenation often will oxidize. I didn't know this when I was younger, too. If you buy, like, vegetable oils, not canola usually, but other vegetable oils, and you leave them in your cupboard for, I don't know, 4 years like I do, they will oxidize and get bitter. So you really have to, like, dip your finger in and taste it before you put it in your chocolate chip cookies. Otherwise, the chocolate chip cookies will taste pretty... I mean, I'm sure you can still get your friends and family to eat them, but these are chocolate chip cookies.
This is food Thursday,
but they will
folks.
Not taste the same because those oils have oxidized from the exposure to the oxygen in the air.
All right, let's go to our phone lines. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll start in Scotia. Tom, you're on.
Howdy. I'll get you back into hot water again.
All right, good.
So I recently bought on-demand electric hot water heater. Got rid of the one with the big tank. It has a bunch of copper pipe go through and takes a pile of electricity and throws it at the water when you ask for heat. I understand from the instructions that the thing will develop deposits of on the inside of the pipe. And we have very hard water, so I suspect it'll do it rather fast. And they suggest running something like vinegar through it, acid, to take away the calcification. So I figured out how to do that, bought a pump and a bucket and stuff like that. And I would like to know, I also bought a pH meter because I'd like to know that I'm getting something. And
the question is how
to quantify it. I put the meter in the acid when it starts off and it reads 2.1 or something like that. If I put it in when I'm done and it reads 4, I take it I did better. If it reads 7, you need to add some more, I think. But am I thinking right with that, or what do you guys think?
Well, it's a good try. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. That's almost a good idea.
Okay.
It's very difficult to do that by analyzing pH. There would be better ways of doing it. But if you're doing it kind of a continuous flow, you're right that it will start off being that what's coming through is going to be a higher pH because the carbonates in there that you're dissolving are neutralizing the acid. When you're done, the pH is the same as the vinegar, then that means you've washed everything out.
Right. So are you using the same vinegar and recycling that over and over again, or are you putting new vinegar in and then checking the effluent, the flow out? Are you constantly feeding in new vinegar, or is it the same vinegar that you're circling through?
Well, no. I mean, it goes, the bucket is starts out as vinegar, and you run it through, and it comes back into the bucket after it goes through the thing.
Okay.
So it's progressively weaker as you use up the calcium.
Well, if it is weakening, then it's definitely taking in calcium, so that's not a major problem. Normally, though, I tell you, I have the same system at my house. If you put vinegar in it or you put in clear, for example, which you can also do, usually you start getting white particulates coming out because it starts to effectively loosen it from the pipes, and then that stuff comes out. And if you see that, then you know you're okay. If you don't, then it's probably not strong enough.
Or you don't have any scale. You don't have scale. Realistically, the best way to extend the life of your water heater is to treat your water before it goes into the water heater. Yeah. Even just a basic water softener should do it. It will take a lot of the hardness ions out from that. So,
yep.
And under $1,000 and you can be done with that. And you know how much those hot water heaters are. You don't want to be replacing them too
often. Right, you are. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Ed Stander and Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabets. And Barbara's getting out of a meeting today, so ask her many questions. Let's go to Rick in Hudson. Rick, you're on.
Hi. Well, you guys have been in coffee, which is often mud, and then you went to schist, even darker, but I'd like to lift it up into outer space.
Okay.
And my question is about the magnetic field of astral bodies. Earth has a north and south pole magnetically, and I recently read that a planet was seen where the magnetic poles change almost every 72 hours. And I was wondering what kind of effect that might have on any kind of global surface of these things. I've been told that, like, the things drain clockwise up here and counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. Is this true?
It is true, but only on a very, very large scale. In other words, don't expect your toilet to go in different directions in the southern and northern hemisphere. But that has nothing to do with magnetics. Magnetics happen in the core of the planet, and they're sort of an additive thing. In other words, when you have a magnetic fluid or a fluid rotating, it produces a magnetic field. And as the core rotates, it produces sort of gyres of magnetism, and they become additive so that sometimes it points in one direction, sometimes it points in another direction. It's not always the same. In fact, on the Earth, it changes poles about once every 10,000 years. And in the meantime, the pole changes position. It used to be in Canada. Now the Russians have it. So,
yeah,
things change over time simply because it's a fluid dynamics that's going on in the core.
And how does that affect surface conditions, geological or biological?
Well, geological, it can affect the rocks that form at the surface. For example, if you have a lava coming out, that'll have magnetic particles in it, and those magnetic particles can align themselves up to the magnetic signature of the Earth. That's how we know that it's flipped over time.
Mm-hmm. Our magnetic field.
That's how they discovered?
Right. That's how they discovered it. And as far as biological, well, you don't want to be a bird in that environment.
No. And it probably is too hostile an environment with that magnetic switch for anything that, well, it's hard to say, okay? Exobiology is a burgeoning field, and certainly we don't have a lot of evidence with it. We all have, you know, you can get a PhD in exobiology, but I think a lot of it's just theoretical.
The only thing I can assume is that on these planets, there really isn't that doesn't exist that kind of life.
Even single-celled organisms can orient themselves to a magnetic field. With a magnetic field that flip-flops every 72 hours, you have to assume that that would not be a real benefit to anything that developed biologically on that planet. So they could be just kind of agnostic about it.
I'm seeing a new science fiction movie going on here, kind of life form that can exist.
Interesting.
If you want to see something really poor,
if you want to see
something really poor, just watch The Core.
Yep. All right, let's go now to Montgomery, New York. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. We have Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander with us today to answer your questions. Anne is in Montgomery. Anne, go ahead.
Hi. So, first of all, I think I just heard you say that the North Pole is now in Russia, and I'm a little bit upset that they have Santa Claus in their possession.
Well, that's the magnetic pole.
That's the magnetic pole, and Santa Claus does not believe in magnetic poles, so it's okay.
Yeah, he's up at the geographic north.
He's still safe. Okay.
Yeah, he's fine.
I feel better.
He's fine. He's not a communist. It's fine.
Okay. No, I didn't think he was communist.
Okay.
But he does wear a red coat.
So going back to coffee... I have a theory about why it cools off faster after it's been in the microwave.
Okay.
And that is that it is, if you cook it in your coffee maker or whatever, as you said earlier, the water is much hotter, the liquid is much hotter, and the heat from the water transfers into the mug. So the physical mug. So I'm thinking that there's sort of a symbiotic relationship there, that's probably the wrong word, where the mug is helping to keep the liquid warm. Whereas if it comes out of the microwave, only the liquid is warm, it's not as warm, and the container is not warm at all. And therefore it would cool off.
Depends on the container.
I don't know.
So does that make any sense?
It makes sense, but I mean, when you put hot water in a cup, the cup heats up.
Yeah, you're still going to get, as soon as the material in the cup warms up more than room temperature, there is going to be heat transfer from that material to the cup, even if it's in the microwave. So as long as you're heating up the liquid inside the cup is getting warmer, you're going to have heat transfer to that mug.
Okay.
And some materials that are microwave safe.
Thanks,
right. You get pretty hot.
Yeah, because
they also get heated up by the microwave radiation.
I think this whole discussion is based on an assumption in the first place. Somebody has to do the experiment and prove it one way or the other.
Well, we don't know which coffee maker we're using and so on.
I don't drink coffee.
You don't drink coffee?
No.
Do you drink hot water?
Yes.
Okay, well do it that way then.
I'll do hot water for next time.
That's your homework there, Ed Stander. Let's go to Frederick and Colony. Frederick, you're on.
How's everybody doing?
Pretty good.
With the hot water heater, two things. Back about 4 years ago, they put a development kitty corner to me. Ever since then, I've been getting air in the lines, hammering.
Mm-hmm.
But Sunday, the hot water heater, it was a lot of air that day, and it was hammering pretty hard. But when I went to use the hot water, like to do dishes after dinner, I had no hot water. I had cold water, but I turned it to hot. I had nothing.
Hmm.
There was so much air. Do you know where that air is coming from? I mean, that was my theory about the development.
Right.
Where else would air come and lock the system for the hot water?
When you heat water, air exsolves. It comes out of solution.
Like bubbles, like boiling.
Bubbles. In fact, if you take a pot of water and you put it on the stove and you heat it up, you start getting bubbles forming. Those bubbles are air that was in the water that, when you heated it, came out of the water.
Even in a closed system like that?
Even in a closed system, yeah.
Interesting.
See, the town says it's not their problem.
Well, I think if we get further into this, we're all going to be in trouble, Frederick. I'm not sure what to say about it, man.
But if you if the water in the pipe that we'll say is not in your house gets turbulent, right? So it sloshes around because, I don't know, bulldozer pushes on a line or something, and it sloshes. If it has any contact with air whatsoever, it'll grab more oxygen, more air, and therefore there will be more air encased. It should be only an event that happens during that construction. If it's still happening, then you need to have some kind of a bleeder on your system to remove that air before it gets to your hot water heater.
So here's the thing, Frederick. I believe Darren Tracy, our home maintenance and plumbing guy, will be on next month. And so I suggest you table this question and ask him. He might have some practical solutions for you rather than theoretical.
Yeah, because I went to different sinks, and I went to the bathroom, and I turned the shower head on.
Ah.
I couldn't even stand the noise. It was so bad with the hammer and all that air in there.
Well, that's not good.
Yeah. But was it just the one occasion, or is it still happening?
Well, I'm putting a new hot water heater in, so I drained the whole system out. I'm putting a new hot water heater in, and I'm putting a hammer aspirator.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And a thermal expansion tank.
Right, That was what I was going to recommend, is a thermal expansion tank before the hot water heater.
Yeah, what normally happens in a house is after a while, the bladder in the thermal expansion tank gets weak and it fills up with water and then it doesn't do its job anymore.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, Frederick, we have to take a break here. It's too exciting. 800-348-2551. I got to take my high blood pressure meds, and we'll take a short break and we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum. Ray Graff here, along with the scientists Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. This email came to voxpop@wamc.org from Bree. Bree writes, quite a long time ago now, I was listening to the Science Forum. One of the experts said that electricity rates are not as different at night now, so it didn't make sense to use a timer for appliances such as a dishwasher. My concern with that answer is that running appliances overnight when the electricity generating stations are creating electricity that's not being used is still better for the environment. Or is this no longer the case as well? Thanks so much for shedding light on this, and have a great day. That's from Bree.
It's no longer the case. There's now a VTOU, I just read about this,
okay,
voluntary time of use meter that you can put on your house. And what it does is the electric company will charge you 8 or 9 cents a kilowatt hour during the day and 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour between 11 o'clock at night and 7 o'clock in the morning. So if you put something like that on, it becomes much, much cheaper as far as electricity is concerned. As far as electricity, they're making it no matter what. And it's very hard to store so that during the night, you've got all this electricity. Somebody has to use it, which is one of the reasons why they're now telling people to charge their electric cars at night and to run dishwashers and other things at night as well.
Okay.
But the voluntary time of use meter is a really, really good idea. It's something to look at for that.
And the general term that we use in the industry is peak shaving. We want to make sure that when everyone needs energy at the same time, like on a hot day at 4:30 in the afternoon, that's when demand starts to have the grid fall apart, right? There's too much demand and not enough supply. So if you distribute your use throughout the day, then you can effectively peak shave the total demand of an area and therefore prevent another power plant from being opened. I mean, those are the goals of the environmental movement, is to cut back on our peaks.
All right. Michael in Rhinebeck has a different question. Why does vanilla ice cream taste colder than chocolate ice cream?
Gosh, I never really thought about it.
I didn't know that was true.
Colder means tastes colder.
I have no idea why that
I will take that one for homework.
With his coffee.
Oh, boy, here's a question about water. Jim, I know you wanted some more questions about water, so here we go. This is from E. Heating water in a microwave oven can cause an explosion effect of uneven heating. People have been burnt when the superheated water shot up in their eyes. It's my understanding there is danger of water shooting up into someone's eyes if the water pops after removing a cup of water from microwave. Temperature of the coffee can be easily tested with a food thermometer. 135 to 140 is usually a drinkable temperature. Just taste the beverage. When you find that works for you, use the food thermometer to find out what works.
And never, ever take water out of a microwave and put hot chocolate in it. Put chocolate powder in it or something like
that.
Because it'll blow up in your face.
And you don't have to necessarily wash your dishes that cleanly, because super clean water in a super clean cup is how you end up with superheated water in a microwave. Because they need nucleation sites for superheating only happens if you don't have nucleation sites along the inside of your cup.
All right, E, thanks for that one. Stephen in Pine Bush. Electrons is the subject heading. As I drive my electric car, does the car get lighter because the battery is losing electrons to work the motor?
No, because those electrons go right back into the battery.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's just on the other pole of the battery.
Oh, yeah? So. Well, have you ever measured that?
That's your homework.
It's got to be. Otherwise, it would generate a net charge, and it doesn't.
All right, what do you say we go back to the phones? 800-348-2551 is the number. Arnie is in Housatonic. Arnie, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. This is an out-of-season question.
Okay.
It's more of a winter question. But,
all right.
A few years back, a buddy and I did some work at a house where we did some landscaping, and we trimmed some trees and cut some brush and built a big bonfire. And we ran out of time to light it that night, so we decided to do it the next morning. And on my way home, I bought a 12-pack of beer, and I left it in my truck overnight. I forgot to mention this is February or January, I believe. It was really cold.
Okay.
It got down to, in the teens that night. So I'm heading over the next morning, and based on past experience, I wasn't that worried. It was inside the truck and in a cardboard carton, but I opened it up and held it up. It looked fine. So we get to the job and light the fire. And, being 5 o'clock somewhere, I decided to grab a couple bottles and we crack them open, watching the fire, take one sip. stand there a minute watching the fire, go to take another sip, and they're frozen solid.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like an ice cube, but like slush.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go to the truck. I grab a couple more bottles. This time we cracked them open. After that first swig, we held our thumb on top of the bottle, and they didn't freeze.
Right.
So my question, what happened?
Great question.
Okay, we were talking about superheating water because you need nucleation, something for the bubble to grow on when you're boiling water. Similarly, when things freeze, they generally like to have something to nucleate it, the crystal. So in this case, it was probably the bubbles,
the carbon dioxide,
when you opened the beer, that acted as the nucleating agent for the water to freeze. But
so the outside atmosphere somehow affected the beer?
Well, no.
Change in pressure.
What happened was that it got colder than the freezing point. So it got that bottle of beer was less than 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was ready
even
to freeze.
After sitting in the truck all night, it was that warm, huh?
No, that
less
cold.
Than.
No, that cold. It was below the freezing point of water. But it hadn't frozen yet because there was nothing to nucleate making the ice crystals.
Mm-hmm.
But when you pop the top off, you get the bubbles of carbon dioxide coming out, and that could have dislodged other particles that may have been on the wall of the bottle, or maybe just the bubbles themselves, was enough to cause the ice crystals to start to form.
Yeah. Effectively, you were really lucky, because if it had gotten a lot colder, then it may have started to simultaneous nucleate, and that would have burst the bottles, and you'd have nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've had that happen. I've been around a while with beer, so that does happen. But
when you put your finger on the top of it, what you did is you stopped the pressure from being released, so the bubble stopped forming, and as a result, it never happened.
So that's good science, Arnie. Thanks for that one. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Mark is in East Monton, Vermont. You're on.
Hey, guys. So I'm just listening about your boiling or running vinegar through the coils. And I have a steam heat system. I have very hard water. And I have to do that to the coil of my boiler, because that's what heats my hot water.
Okay.
But what I do basically is I get a 5-gallon bucket, I shut the thing off, I put about a gallon and a half, 2 gallons of vinegar, white vinegar, and I let it run for an hour with my sump pump. And by doing that, it turns greenish and so on and so forth. But when I get done, you can see all these little pieces of material from the coil. But also with steam heat, so many people are pulling these systems out, and steam heat is a beautiful heat.
Okay. All right.
That is working well.
I like it. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. That's the number here on the Science Forum. It's been a very varied program here. Let's go to Terry in Guilford, Connecticut. Terry, you're on.
Hi, Ray. My question has to do with the sun having a 22-year polarity cycle where magnetic fields, it goes halfway every 11 years with the sunspot cycle. But every 11 years, from my understanding, it changes the poles of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct. And while we're not really sure why it happens, what appears to be happening is that in the sun, there are a number of different currents going on inside the sun itself, and these are either additive or subtractive. So it behaves effectively the same way as the core of the Earth rotating. Sometimes the two add together and you get a stronger solar cycle. Sometimes they're weaker, you get a weaker solar cycle. And then the flip occurs depending on which one is stronger than the other.
You get it, Terry?
Yeah, I know that there's been a lot of activity. There was like an aurora. I didn't see it, but I know there were like photos of it all around the region. So I know I just missed it because I got a view blockage with some trees. But
yeah,
but even in Long Island and
and
here in Guilford, I'm about 20 miles north of like the center of Long Island, basically.
Right.
Well, go to spaceweather.com any day of the week, and it'll tell you whether an aurora is coming or not.
And there are still plenty.
Yeah, there's a little map. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So, Terry, thanks a lot for that one. Alan writes in, there's no such thing as a hot water heater. Well, this is all caps. He's shouting. You don't need to heat hot water. It's a cold water heater. Noted, Alan. Thank you for that one. That's very, very helpful. This is from Ryan. Going back to the chocolate and vanilla ice cream. Does chocolate ice cream have a higher fat content, which then coats your palate? I've thought about vanilla hitting colder than chocolate in the past, too, and that's the only conclusion I've come to.
Well, it depends. Usually hot vanilla and chocolate are both made with a custard, which is eggs. And so apart from the chocolate itself, there really isn't a large difference between the two of them.
And there's really not a lot of chocolate in chocolate ice cream.
No.
And most commercial ice creams, and I won't say all because there are purists out there, there's an extra added piece. Guar is added, or carrageenan.
What is so, guar gum, by the way?
Is it a surfactant? It's to simulate the same consistency that you would get in a custard. So it kind
Why don't
of
you just put custard
thing
in? Yeah.
More expensive.
And it's made
more
from
caloric.
It's made from seaweed, so it's much cheaper as
guar?
Well.
Yes.
Guar is really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll be darned.
So I think if you were dealing with a premium gourmet ice cream, maybe there's a higher fat content in your super chocolate, but boy, you know, vanilla people are very particular. They like to have it loaded as well.
And that is the question, because when I go and I start testing ice creams, I'll make sure that the ice creams have consistent production, because a lot of ice creams are not made with cream.
You know what? You need a budget for this. We have to get you several hundred
NPR,
dollars.
I've already contacted NSF. Yeah. I've already contacted NSF. I think I can find the budget.
Okay. Otherwise, we'll have to do a second fund drive here, or a third or fourth.
Kresge Foundation.
By the way, Fran writes in, how does the body differentiate between an itch and pain?
Oh, that I need a whiteboard for. Boy, that's tough on the radio.
Well, you have 1 minute. No, go ahead. No, as long as you want. Go ahead.
It's
take it for homework.
Yeah, okay. I've got to figure out how to do it without trying to draw things on the radio.
Okay, fair enough.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't even know that was a thing. So that's thank you, Fran, for that one. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. We'll go to Ernest in Poston Kill. The importance of being Ernest in Poston Kill. You're on.
Hello. Hey, this is about human weight gain and loss. I know how weight is gained, right? If muscle, proteins, bone, fat. But I struggle understanding where the weight goes when you lose it. And there's people that lose hundreds of pounds. This matter cannot be created or destroyed, only altered. Where does that weight go?
It goes into carbon
dioxide and water that you exhale.
I tell my students that there is a that the amount of fat in the world is stays the same all the time. It's the law of conservation of fat, and if you lose some, then somebody else has to gain it.
Oh, that's interesting.
But, you know, Jim is right. Ultimately, what we have done is our bodies store calories in kind of like a battery format in tissue. So fat being one, protein being another. And then there's even storage of short-term carbohydrates that are done in the liver and in the blood. That's why, you know, they carbo load before a marathon. So if you're talking about weight loss and it's not like cancer, right? You don't have cancer, then you're usually losing fat. That's the big energy store that people want to get rid of, right? To break down those fat molecules, the fat cells themselves don't go away. They just deflate like a deflated balloon. But the material that's inside those cells, the lipids and the fats, those are oxidized. They're reacted. in a chemical reaction similar to burning wood, only it's burning fat in your body. And the byproducts of that are carbon dioxide, oxygen, and water. And so you exhale it, you get rid of it, sweat it out, all that kind of stuff, all of those different ways that you can get rid of those two materials. And then, you know, if you do have protein breakdown, for example, you lose muscle mass, like as you age and you get skinnier, then that often gets broken down and is put into your urine and your feces, because those cells will actually break down and then be recycled. But fat cells just deflate, unfortunately, unless you have surgery.
Let's go to Jerry in Chatham. Hello, Jerry.
Hi there. Okay, so I'd like you to check my math on this.
Okay.
I've been reading books about the age of the Earth and all that kind of stuff and trying to create something that means something to me. So here's the situation. 4.5 billion years is to 300,000, as 5,280 is to X.
Okay.
I get 4 inches. Is that right?
Four inches?
What are we talking about?
So he's saying if he's comparing a mile to the age of the universe or to the
age of the Earth?
Yeah.
Age of the Earth.
The age of the Earth started 4.5 billion years ago, and Homo sapiens arrived about 300,000 years ago.
Right.
And expressing that as a mile, 5,280, I get 4 inches, like Homo sapiens appeared in the last 4 inches.
Oh, that sounds plausible.
Yeah, that's about right. Exactly. Human history started about 2 molecules from the end of the mile. Yep, that works about right.
Okay.
Well, that's great.
All I wanted to know.
Jerry, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay, we only have about a minute here. Let's go to Sarah, who's on the road. Sarah, where are you?
Hey, Sarah. I'm just I'm in Del Mar right now. So I think the first question I was going to try and answer for you has already been answered. That was about the vanilla and the chocolate ice cream.
Yep.
And chocolate having more cocoa solids is going to – it's not that the temperature is different. It's just that the perception of temperature is different on the palate of vanilla to chocolate. The second thing, just following on from the last caller, that relates to Carl Sagan's cosmic calendar, which is relating the span of time to a year instead of to a mile, but I like the mile analogy better. So an actual question for the panel. If fat-free milk contains vitamin D and vitamin D is fat-soluble, how do they get the vitamin D in the fat-free milk?
I love that. All right, we have 1 minute, people. Less than that.
It's emulsified, so you have, you know, it's homogenized. Milk is obviously stuff that's creamy and not creamy, and so there are little tiny droplets that have the material in it with the vitamin D.
Okay.
Those tiny droplets of fat, then?
Yep.
Barely, but yes. I mean, fat-free is not zero. It's just below 1%. It rounds to zero.
All right, Sarah, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for the call. All right, people. So, Barbara Brabitz, you're beginning school in 2 weeks?
Yes, I'm teaching general biology, general chemistry, and microbiology.
And, Ed, when do you begin your classes, geology?
About 5 minutes after Barbara does.
Really?
Yeah.
You're always a little late?
Well, I let her students see what she's doing, and then they come and rush
towards
me.
Yeah, I'm 9:30, he's 10 o'clock, for real.
Right. And then, Jim, you're up at the racetrack hanging out, yeah?
No, I'm not a big brace fan. But
no, I'm not either.
We're getting ready to go to Cape Cod.
Oh, good for you.
Oh, stand in line instead.
You're going to do some science out there? You're going to hang out?
Yeah, I'm going to do photochemistry.
Get your melanin all excited.
Nice and tan. All right, all. Well done. Very strange show, but we got through it. And thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from Oblong Books, with books, toys, games, and puzzles for summer reading and gifting needs in Rhinebeck, at Millerton, and online, oblongbooks.com. Thanks again to Ed Stander and Barbara Brabitz and Jim Pickett. And thanks to our affable engineer, Zachary Malloy. A nod. That's more than I get usually. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. Thanks a lot. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the show, forget about it. It's cheese. We'll welcome Shalina Bridgham from Four Fat Fowl and Mary Rizzo from The Cheese Traveler. Like me some cheese. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.